You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. You're also listening to Praxis. As you know, if you've been listening this summer, I have a whole bunch of pre-recorded shows in the can. I was super excited to meet this person. He's someone who has, you know, been somewhat of a pioneer in areas that I'm really interested in, specifically in organizing white people around anti-racist work and basically getting white folks to defect from white supremacy, de facto and overt. So without further introduction, here is the interview that I recorded with Chris Crass. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you have one of the best alliterative names of any guest in the past.
Well, it was strategic. Chris Crass, it was like, okay, CC, mm-hmm. like Lois Lane, Peter Parker. Mm-hmm. Like, we gotta have CC.
So
Chris
Carbon Crass. Copy. Yep. You exactly. better CC. Yep. Exactly. That's very smooth. So, welcome to Spokane. I know you're just in town for the Unitarian General Assembly right now, and you've been able to connect with some local anti-racist activists. But I'm hoping maybe you can just introduce yourself and just talk a little bit about your background with activism, with this work, and kind of a little bit about your journey to where you are right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I came into social justice activism when I was 15 in high school, and a lot of seeds had been planted by my parents that really took off in high school as I started meeting other young people who were activists, who were social justice people. But in particular, in my family, you know, I grew up in a family where, you know, my grandfather, my uncles, you know, regularly talked about a racist worldview of really being working class, a working class white extended family, and talking about the ways that, you know, the quality of life, the affordability of life, of jobs and housing and just all of these things that were becoming more and more of a struggle. As wages were declining, as union jobs were declining, and blaming all of that on people of color, on black women and undocumented workers. And so my mom really arguing back. And so as a young kid, 3 years old, 7 years old, 12 years old, seeing and hearing my mom argue back was profound. And, and again, as an activist, it wasn't like this thing where, like, the first time I heard, you know, my mom arguing for justice or for anti-racism that I was like, oh yes, of course, I'm a lifelong activist. You know, it took years later, which I always try to remember in terms of thinking about the pace of change and giving people opportunities for growth, and that just because somebody doesn't respond or it doesn't resonate in the first encounter with social justice values and politics, we need to continue to nourish and create culture that brings more and more people in. Because once I met young people when I was in high school who were social justice oriented, had social justice values, and were talking about going to protests and listening to social justice punk rock music, I was like, yes, sign me up for life. And so, you know, going to protests, going, starting up an activist group mm-hmm. in high school, listening to, politically conscious punk rock, and it was really powerful. And so over time, you know, being a social justice activist, being against economic inequality, seeing the ways that corporate greed was destroying the planet and dehumanizing us, but then really for me, a major turning point in my life was I was 18 when the Rodney King verdict came down in Los Angeles. You know, so black motorist pulled over late at night for speeding, brutally beaten by four white police officers with a much larger group of police officers surrounding them. Rodney King was brutally beaten, tasered over and over again. It was videotaped. It was all over the news, went viral. I thought for sure that, you know, here it is. It's on tape. It's like right there. Something had to happen with these cops. Then the verdict came out. Acquittal, no charges. Just like Trayvon Martin with Zimmerman, acquittal, no charges. Sandra Bland, no responsibility of the police. You know, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, over and over and over again, these acquittal, acquittal, acquittal. And so the Rodney King verdict, when Los Angeles went up in flames, with tens of thousands of people coming out to protest, I was 30 minutes away in the suburbs of Los Angeles, and it just really blew my mind. And I knew that I didn't understand the realities of institutional racism. I didn't understand the experiences of people of color, because of course I wouldn't. I was raised, my parents did a really great job of trying to raise me to not be racist. And the best that they had was kind of a colorblind love sees no color, mm-hmm. which, you know, which it's like a lot of white people trying to do the best they can. That's then a framework that they try to embrace. But nonetheless, I was raised to be illiterate about the realities of racism, about the realities of white supremacy, about the realities of enduring police violence, so that when tens of thousands of mostly people of color, but also white anti-racists too, took to the streets in Los Angeles, I knew in my heart that I was with them. I knew in my heart that this verdict was unjust and outrageous, and I was in tears and angry. But I also knew that I was very ill prepared to understand what was going on or what could be done to resist and change things. And so that's when I started, you know, a friend of mine, you know, black friend was like, you know, you need to learn a lot more about black history. You need to learn a lot more about black social justice movements, people of color led movements, you know. And then my mom was like, and you also need to learn more about women leaders and women led organizations. And, you know, that really changed my life, you know, starting to study people of color history, starting to study feminist leadership, women's leadership. And that really sent me on a trajectory that I'm still on of how can I, as a white person, work for racial justice in a powerful way? How can I, as a man, work for feminism also in a liberatory, powerful way as part of all of us getting free from structural inequality and cultures of supremacy and violence?
Wow, that's awesome. And sounds like you lucked out in the mom department.
Oh, yeah. And the friends department. I totally lucked out.
Yeah. Well, and I really like what you said, because, you know, a lot of your work and a lot of the work around engaging white people in, you know, defecting from white supremacy and from joining anti-racist struggles in a meaningful way is around, I don't think it's all about hearts and minds. I think that people present hearts and minds because it feels better than action. But to some extent, it is about changing the way people think. So I kind of wanted to revisit what you said, that you didn't necessarily hear it the first time you heard your mom stand up to, you know, your uncle, your grandpa. What do you think, how do you think that works for folks? And does that process that you remember as a kid influence how you operate today and kind of your theory of change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, so for me, thinking about racial justice and anti-racism, it's like, how do we create many, many opportunities for people, for white people to learn, to engage, and that it's a journey, that not expecting a white person to go from, you know, because I had, you know, when I first started really becoming conscious about anti-racism, I like wanted to go and shake white people, you know, and be like, do you realize that racism is this enduring reality and we have to do something? Like, wake up, you know? And it was like, okay, well, I need to be real about, like, okay, it was a long journey for me and I was still on my journey. And so I was like, okay, I have to think about this as an organizer, as somebody who is deeply committed to, and I love that this show is called Praxis, because someone who's, that for me, I'm deeply committed to liberation praxis. And by praxis, for me, it's not just, okay, we have good ideas and then we put good ideas out into the world. And if people don't immediately gravitate to those good ideas, well, then forget them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like praxis is this idea of that through our ideas and theories, but it's also how we act and begin to embody. And the, it's a journey that, you know, like Paulo Freire, you know, and Miles Horton, incredible social justice educators, they talk about, we make the road by walking. And so we have to allow people to know that there's this justice road, help them get on it, and help support them in making their own road by walking. So providing references, resources, inspiration, nourishment. And so for me, it was realizing, okay, you know, like it took me a long time. And in part, I didn't, you know, the racism is so prevalent, conscious, racism, unconscious racism, conservative right-wing hate racism, liberal, really progressive, condescending, people of color just need, you know, to have a white person come and save them, mm-hmm. racism. It's all over the place. So for white people to come into anti-racism, there's a lot of white people are starving when it comes to liberation values, when it comes to anti-racist values in particular. Men are starving when it comes to values around gender justice and feminism. And so for me, it's as an organizer, how do we create nourishment for our people? Mm-hmm. How do we create ways in which white people are learning about things that can inspire and move them to want to be a part of this work? As opposed to, and I understand sometimes, you know, you just need to say in a group, this is racist. And some white people are going to feel a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. They're going to be in denial. They're going to have a really hard time. So I understand sometimes with like the Black Lives Matter movement, we need to be able to just take positions around like, you know what, this is racist, this is wrong. And it's a both and. So sometimes we need to take these really strong public positions of like calling out the racism that exists, the violence that is happening against communities of color, and say like either whether what you're doing is racist, this institution is racist, what's happening right now, even in a, you know, a bunch of good white people who are, you know, I'm a good white person. But if you're just a good white person who's not actively trying to be anti-racist, then good white people participate in horrible things all the time, mm-hmm. from good Germans to good, you know, folks who were living in the time of enslavement to right now, good people who are really beautiful people but aren't connected to. We need to end this mass incarceration of people of color and this mass system of detainment of undocumented children and families. I mean, concentration camps for Japanese in World War II being used to become a concentration camp for undocumented children. This is happening right now. Mm-hmm. And so for me, realizing that we need to both take these like major stands and positions around ending racism, and we need folks, anti-racist white people, who can do the long-term work of having conversations with white people, putting out anti-racist culture, putting out people of color history to help support white people to learn about that history. The, you know, people of color often talk about like, I'm not here for white tears. As a white anti-racist organizer, I'm here for white tears. If those tears could be used to help open people's hearts to the pain and reality of racism and bring them into racial justice struggle. So there's a both and of, mm-hmm. yes, we need to like really mobilize, take action, support. Oftentimes in communities of color, it's like, this is a life and death struggle. I need white folks to show up and have our back and call out the racism. And we need white anti-racist organizers who are doing the slow and ongoing work of bringing more and more white people, mm-hmm. into an understanding of liberation connected to ending racism for men, ending patriarchy, and how we can have multiracial democracy, economic justice, dignity for all. That these things are the result of our coming together across these divisions, ending, working to undermine racism, undermine sexism, and come together as a powerful people to create a healthy society for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amen. I just found myself about to make a sports metaphor, which is very not my brand, but
hey, I'm going to roll with it. So we can go for it.
I don't fully understand them, so don't judge my sports metaphor.
Neither do I, but I just like sports metaphors. And I don't understand sports enough that even if your metaphor is not on, I would be like, yeah, that's okay. What makes sense to me.
So I think, you know, when you're talking about white tears, and I think also talking about the concept of education, that it's not the role of people of color to educate white people about racism or really about anything else, unless that person's an educator, I guess. But I think the role of white anti-racists can almost be to like intercept like incoming white people who either have enthusiasm, but they're not quite there on their analysis, or who are actively, you know, problematic. And, you know, I think that that's part of the role of other white people, because you can lower that level of defensiveness. You can be somebody who maybe is more relatable just on that like bias level. So yeah, running interception on those folks,
which I think is really hard because I know for me, and I know we talked about this yesterday when we had a really in-depth conversation with some white anti-racist organizers, it's really hard to get out of that smugness phase. You go through the guilt phase and then you go through the smugness phase of, you know, being more woke than thou, et cetera, and not wanting to be in the presence of those people who aren't there. So I guess, what advice do you have for people? And do you have a description of kind of those standard developmental phases that people go through? And I don't know, what's your advice on moving through those and moving back and forth cyclically through those? You know, I don't think it's a linear journey either.
Yeah, I totally agree that it's an ongoing process, an ongoing journey. And I will say that it's important for people to know that over time, the work evolves. And so, and I say that because, you know, the first, you know, year or two of really as a white person starting to be reading all this stuff about racism and the realities of the history and the current reality of it, it's heartbreaking and devastating. And I'm not saying that the heartbreak goes away, but what I am saying is that for a while, it can be really kind of terrifying about, like, oh my gosh, there's so many things that I've done and I've said that I wasn't even aware of. And I'm like nervous to even say anything now, or I'm really self-conscious when I'm around people of color, or I'm just like really angry at white people who don't get it, because it's just like, it's screaming in my face right now. And so when it's like screaming in your face, you're just like, how could you, to other white people, how could you not see this? How could you not hear this? And so, you know, I understand that. But then over time, it's starting to be able to, like, okay, you know what? I'm starting to learn more. It's starting to become a part of who I am. And so I'm able to, you know, really encouraging people to be able to then start to be able to feel more grounded, more comfortable, more being able to connect with people of color in a more just open-hearted, grounded way, and not just like constantly in your head of like, oh my gosh, am I going to say the wrong thing? Am I going to say the wrong thing? And then you start to act, you know, really awkward and strange around trying to interact with people of color. And you know, and I get that's part of it, because white supremacy doesn't want white people to interact in a genuinely humane, mutually respectful, mutually dignified way with people of color. It's like white people treat people of color as inferior, as there to serve you or as there for entertainment, but not as a peer or a mentor or a leader. So I get that. And the, like what you said about the smugness towards other white people, I mean, I totally get that. And so for the first like few years of being a social justice activist, or then an anti-racist or a feminist or whatever, it's understandable that you're going to be in this place of feeling superior to other people like you. But it's crucial to work through that, to do the healing work, because a lot of that's our own pain and our own shame or our guilt that we're projecting onto other people. And so I'm not trying to do, I don't want to work with other white people in a way where I'm like, all my unhealed emotional pain and trauma is coming out on other white people or other men. So doing that emotional, spiritual work of healing, of learning about white anti-racist role models, of being able to do, because white supremacy messes us up as white people, this like perfectionism, this, you know, competition with others, this you have to do everything yourself. So even like coming into community with other white people around anti-racism to get support. And I know you organize, you know, the local Surge chapter. So finding ways for white people to be able to be in community with each other, to heal that internal stuff around racism, and then to be able to move from that more place of like, I'm more woke than you, into more of like, how do I want to create organizing liberation praxis of creating a culture or organizational opportunities where more and more, I'm not trying to be better than other white people. I'm not trying to be better than other men. I want to help be a leader that helps support more and more white people, more and more men to come into this work, because that's what we need for structural cultural change. And those are the steps, that's the journey that's going to help us create the kind of world that we want to live in, beloved community, sacred community, justice community. So, but it's a process, you know, so I think it's like that, like not being aware, coming into awareness, shock, guilt, shame, moving from there into kind of more of the like super righteous activist, like everyone, I'm, you know, I've got it all figured out. Why aren't you all here with me? Then it can kind of turn into a jaded smugness of just sort of like, you know, where activism almost becomes just sort of like talking trash about other people. And then you got to do some healing work. You got to work to actually, you know, we have to regularly do practices of inspiration and regular practices of nourishment, because jadedness and talking trash, it's, I understand that sometimes we need a space to do that with our close friend, but that is activating toxic energy that is inhibiting us, preventing us from being able to truly love our people, love our communities in a way that will bring us into leadership to want to help move people, to help want to get people involved. And the toxic just trash talk will keep us being isolated, ineffective, small, and actively put other people off to us. And so again, I understand the emotional journey that we all have to go on. And I got love for my white people who trash other white people. I got love for my white people who are like super guilty and don't know what to do. I got love for all my white people trying to figure it out wherever you are. I love you. And to continue to be on the journey of becoming white anti-racist liberation organizers, writers, artists, parents, community leaders, community members who are trying to bring more and more people in to build powerful movements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis here on KYRS, talking with Chris Crass, the anti-racist, feminist organizer, activist, educator. I don't know which titles you like, so I'm going to give you all the titles. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because I think it's a really complicated thing, and something I've realized, as you said, working with Surge, which is showing up for racial justice. For folks who don't know, there's chapters all over the country. I know you were one of the founders.
Well, there was a whole lot of us that kind of came together.
You were there at the beginning.
And yeah, exactly.
But I know for a lot of people, even just saying, for a lot of white people, even just saying the phrase white people and referring to yourself as white is a barrier, and that just shows how illiterate we are and how much work we have to do, and how open everyone who wants to be involved in that has to be. And I just wanted to, I mean, what you were saying, the stakes are high for including as many people as possible, because right now the stakes are like fighting literal fascism, you know?
Right.
I mean,
right.
And the stakes have always been high, and the stakes have always been higher for people of color. And I think that white people are just opened up to the danger in a new way. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure we called that out. So, so I wanted to ask you a little bit about, I do want to focus on racism still, but I also always just want to talk to men who are doing work around feminism. Yeah, how did, I mean, you mentioned your mom, but what does that look like for you? What are the overlaps between working on gender equity as the dominant party and working on racial equity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for me, a really important part of my life has been trusting my instincts and my intuition of when to follow people. You know, there's times that are important to lead and be a leader and help, you know, bring other people in and support people to participate. And help develop and talk about vision and why we do this and help organize events and actions, all these kinds of things. And also a crucially important part of my life, and from when I was young to now, is being able to really trust my heart around when really brilliant and important people are showing me a way forward. And so women in my life started talking openly about sexism, both in society, but also within the social justice groups that we were a part of, started talking with me openly about the ways that I participated in sexism, everything from, you know, not trusting women who had been in the group for long periods of time to have leadership, that they would be able to speak at rallies and represent the organization, or if they volunteer to do something like that, being kind of like, well, are you sure? And then like men who would join the group being trusted really quickly to do a lot of public leadership things that women weren't encouraged or supported or believed that they were capable of doing. Women having, you know, putting out ideas in meetings and being ignored, and then a man repeats them, and that, you know, so I mean that happens all the time. And you know, for women and people, you know, on in the feminine galaxy of genders, you know, that's a common experience. But for me, you know, when I was like, you know, a 19 and learning about this stuff, it just blew my mind, and I was heartbroken and I couldn't believe it. And but thankfully there was women who I was like, okay, I want to listen. Thankfully, at a certain point, I just realized that there was times when I just wanted to learn and I wanted to understand, and that I loved the people who were talking to me about sexism, about racism, and I trusted them. Even though patriarchy was telling me this couldn't be true, don't worry about it, this is an exaggeration, they're making a big deal out of nothing, you're fine, you know, what do women know? You know, white supremacy was telling me the same thing about people of color. It was just like really letting my heart lead and learning. And so what that started looking like was, okay, men, like white people, have very few experiences, opportunities, resources around developing a real understanding of patriarchy, of feminism. You know, I mean, feminism is like, oh my gosh, like feminism, that's like anti-men and feminists hate men, all this kind of, you know, nonsense. But starting to really, okay, oh my gosh, like bell hooks, you know, reading bell hooks and her talking about, you know, an incredible woman of color feminist, you know, her books, you know, Feminism is for Everybody, and, you know, From Margin to Center, and so many incredible books. I highly recommend bell hooks if you've not read her. But reading her and her talking about feminism as both ending the oppression against women and girls, and also the ways that patriarchy creates this unhealthy patriarchal masculinity that suppresses the emotional life of men, suppresses the spiritual just ability to grow and be human and be able to experience intimacy and love and tenderness and ask for help and really have authentic, open-hearted connections with others, that patriarchal masculinity wants men to be shut down in, you know, I'm in control, I know everything, I don't need to ask for help, the only emotion I can express is anger, if I express vulnerability, openness, tenderness, then I can be called all kinds of misogynistic words, homophobic words, could potentially get beaten up at the schoolyard or marginalized in the workplace, on and on and on. And so it's just like, oh my gosh, like men, we need to come together. Patriarchy is a nightmare in our lives, and in the lives of women and genderqueer and trans people, absolutely. But even for, you know, cisgender men who are just figuring this stuff out, it's like, oh my gosh, this has had such a devastatingly negative impact on our lives. And so for us to be able to show up in a justice way, in a loving way, in a kind way, in a human way with people of all genders, we as men need to do a lot of healing work, and then also a lot of consciousness raising about how we can bring feminist values into our lives, whether that's around everything from, you know, the ways that we do, you know, housework and raising of our babies, our children. We're not doing childcare, we're parenting our babies, you know, to how we show up in activist spaces and what kinds of work we do, and what leadership and what voices we are actively listening to, paying attention to, supporting women's leadership and work being seen, supported, recognized, followed, but then also working for legislative change, cultural change, policy change, elected official change that moves feminist values forward. So I do a lot of working to bring men together, particularly white men, around an anti-racist feminism that can nourish our hearts and our bodies and our souls from the devastation of racism and patriarchy in our lives, and help us show up in beautiful, powerful, effective ways in solidarity with people of all genders, people of color, to make some serious change in this country that's going to be better for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a good point. And it works across all of the oppressions, but the ways that even the people who presumably benefit, air quotes. We couldn't see your air quotes earlier on good. I always have to like tell people I'm doing really obnoxious air quotes around benefit. It's just a different nightmare, you know, and you're not going to face the structural challenges, but the psychic damage that's done to accept that toxic masculinity and to accept and internalize white supremacy and the idea that our culture is this corporate, bland, weirdly flattened, militaristic culture, and that's what white people are, like that's not fair to anyone. And you know, it's actively harming people of color, but it's passively harming in a different way the white people who are quote benefiting. So yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks for doing that work with men, because I don't want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like you said earlier, it's about different roles and different things that different people can do, you know? And so we don't have to all do the same things. And it's crucial, again, like you said, about roles of like, you know, sometimes, you know, different people are going to be able to do different work in different communities really effectively. And so when organizers of color really encouraged me of, hey, like you need to really figure out how to organize white people. You know, and they were like, you know, we don't know how we organize in our communities and we know the issues that are going on in our communities. But you need to really, you know, yes, of course we want you to like try to help white people to not be so racist. But as far as really being able to get white people to be deeply committed to racial justice, you got to figure out, do some deep work around what that's going to look like, what's going to resonate. And that's like the praxis, concept of like, it was a lot of practicing things. Okay, let's do this around anti-racism. I'm going to do this around feminist work with men. Okay, now the reflection period, which is a crucial part of praxis. What did we learn from trying to put these ideas into practice? Because a lot of times, again, we have these really great ideas about like, well, if we just did this, or why can't people just do this? And then you actually try to make it, put those things into practice, whether that's through activist efforts, whether that's through trying to create some sort of alternative community space, whether that's through whatever it is. But when we put our ideas into practice in reality, they're way more messy. They're way more complicated. There's so much more nuance. It's not this simple like, oh, well, this should do this and well, let's just do that and that should solve that. And so praxis is this way of helping our ideas come into reality and then drawing lessons and insights through reflection, evaluation. How did that go? Why do we think the part that worked really well? Why do we think that worked really well? What didn't work? Okay, why do we think it didn't work? Okay, so now what have we learned to make our next effort even more holistic, even more healthy, even more dynamic, hopefully even more effective? And so praxis is this ongoing journey of how we evolve and grow our activism in a way that expands justice, expands liberation, and brings more and more people in. And when I say bring more and more people in, there's also different levels of participation. So for example, I know in Spokane and other places, there's really powerful work around multiracial alliance building. So for example, you wouldn't have a white person who last week just started realizing that racism exists. You wouldn't say to that person like, oh, okay, why don't you go represent the white progressive organization that we're in? Why don't you go represent them at the next multiracial mm-hmm. alliance strategy discussion? Like, that doesn't make any sense. You're setting up that person to go and be way beyond their experience level. And so we need to be able to, again, why I love praxis is being able to see things developmentally. Mm-hmm. And so over years, I mean, so for example, like you've been doing this work in the community for a long time. You've got this radio show. You're a leader in Surge. You've got a lot of activist experience behind you. You're able to build relationships and do work across differences of race, across differences of class, build political relationships based on the experience that you've developed through a lot of work, where that's where your leadership comes in. You're being able to create study groups, discussion groups, community events where people are learning about this stuff, having something like Surge or the Peace and Justice Coalition, the different organizations here, people joining those, people being mm-hmm. able to participate in those things, and their leadership developing over time. So it's an ecosystem of roles, responsibilities, leadership, participation, and then also this wide spectrum of ways that people can come into the work, get learn about racism, learn about racial justice, men learning about feminism, getting support around that. And then what's crucial, though, is how we create webs of relationship where people are getting mentored, mm-hmm. where people are getting peer support, where people are having leaders encourage them. I see what you're doing. Thank you for what you're doing. And asking people, like, maybe next time, you know, would you be able to help out with this? Or, you know, can you, because new people, they're not going to see all the things that need to be done. Mm-hmm. But leaders are able to say, okay, there's like these 20 different things that need to be done. Let's recruit people, ask people to participate in it. And that brings people in. Mm-hmm. So we need to create lots of opportunities for people to participate and recognize that there's different levels of participation and leadership to help us move this work forward in a powerful way.
Yeah. And I mean, thank you for the kind words about that. And knowing that, you know, it's the perfectionism piece. Like, I've built all those skills and built all those things and definitely still mess up on a pretty regular basis. And it's been amazing. I've been so lucky to have so many good leaders in this community. And if you're out there listening and you're like, who are all these great leaders in our community? Literally, like, scroll through the archive, start seeing who's local, and shoot me an email and I can try to get you connected. Yeah. So speaking of email, actually, I wanted to ask you, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to like call you out, this is like a socially weird thing sometimes, I think you're about 15 years older than me, which means that when you were first organizing as a teenager, I mean, you were definitely not using the internet to do so. And then you're still active now. And culture, social justice culture, I think, based on my experience, has shifted a ton with social media and the internet.
That's true.
I guess I'm just curious your reflection on that. What do you think about, there's a lot of performance, and I think there's always been performance in activist spaces, but I think that there's a lot of danger of performance with social media. So I don't know, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's I think it's a fascinating thing, and I hear the, you know, because yeah, I mean, when I was doing, I had been doing organizing for probably a good like 7 to 10 years before email really became like this big thing. I mean, you know, it's like, I remember when it'd be the thing, like, people would like say, I'm gonna go check my email for an hour for this week. Like, I'm done. I checked my email for an hour. I'm done for the whole week. You know, before cell phones, all this kind of stuff. And so I think the technology has allowed for an incredible amount of connection, relationship building, those kinds of things. But, you know, so when I was an activist, we had a lot of like social justice newspapers, zines that people would put out and distribute. You know, I had pen pals, activist pen pals all over the country. We would have a lot of, I mean, all kinds of different ways that we would communicate, and things were slower. But one of the things that was important, I think, was that it created a little bit more space for analysis and reflection. Whereas like now within the activist world, things move so fast, mm-hmm. That I understand, you know, so people can kind of like talk negatively about this like kind of performative way that you do activism on social media. And it, you know, and I think we have to be real. For me, you know, I've been doing this, you know, I mean, I'm 45. I've been doing this since I was 15. And I have just a tremendous love and compassion for people, especially activists, because I've been in all kinds of different places as an activist, you know, like talking trash, thinking I was so much better than other people, which was like, a lot of it was just my own deep insecurities about my own ability to be an activist and was I doing it okay. And so you trash talk other people to prove how great you are, and just all kinds of things, you know. And I also love self-help books and therapy, you know, so I feel like a good organizer is like super good at both being able to create organizational opportunities and structures and infrastructure and invite people and all that, and is really a good therapist, because good organizing is also helping people work through trauma, mm-hmm. and pain and their own sense of their own worth and dignity and their own sense of their own power, to help people come into a healthy place to then be working for justice in the world. So organizing needs to love our people to heal and grow. And that's been so important for me. And so the social media thing is oftentimes you need to, you're like trying to project your best self. You know, I'm super woke. I'm super awesome. I'm hanging out with all the coolest people. And I get that, you know, you're putting out pictures and you want to make sure that you're putting out like your tweet or your Instagram or your Facebook that like makes you look super awesome all the time. And there's a lot of pressure. So I get that. And it's crucial that we also allow for either through social media or email, but also in person, we allow space for vulnerability and a space for people to breathe, be authentic, be okay with their who they are, not feel like they have to be perfect, not feel like they have to have the best, most amazing Facebook post every day or else they're going to get kicked out. So being able to create opportunities for people to be vulnerable, open, human with each other. And one of the ways that I try to do that is by like just reaching out to people, email, Facebook, text message, whatever, and just like saying, you know what, I love you and I'm so grateful for what you do. And here's like one or two things about what you've done that really, has made a powerful impact in my life. Whether that's like you put your arm around me and encouraged me when I was having a hard time, or you listened to me when I was like really struggling, or, you saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and you encouraged me to do something that I didn't think I was ready for, but you helped me to do it. And now that was amazing. That really had a big impact. So being able to be vulnerable through gratitude, through appreciation, through love, as well as being able to ask for help, you know, asking each other for help around like I'm struggling. Continuing to build authentic relationships and connections, and being really kind that people on social media can often like trash each other, mm-hmm. or tear each other apart, mm-hmm. or
kind of pile on,
you know, or yeah, that's a big... like just like present really like I'm just amazing all the time. And so to be kind and compassionate, that's culturally a lot of what's going on in social media. And so even on your own social media, trying to find ways to be vulnerable and open, but also doing that in person or one-on-one in the technology. So yeah, those opportunities to come together are really important.
Yeah. Yeah, right on. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with Chris Crass. There's a lot of alliteration in there. And we're talking about his work involving white people in anti-racist work and undermining white supremacy, work with men on feminist issues, and all the rest. I wanted to ask you kind of a question I just wanted to ask the other day that's more on the advice scale, since you've been doing this work for a long time. And it has to do with that knowing more, that we have a huge problem on the left, and especially I know we come out of probably a really similar little Venn diagram of the left, of like punk type left, and there's a lot of knowing more than one another and having right. the perfect analysis and blah blah blah.
Right.
How though, I encountered a situation quite some time ago now where I was talking to someone who's an elder of mine who comes out of the Vietnam era, about anti-racism work, and I said something about like, and obviously, you know, capitalism is part of the problem. And that person did not want to hear that, did not want to hear it from me, and basically said like, well, if this is about socialism, I'm not interested. So what's your thought on understanding intersectionality, not only in terms of human beings and how systems of oppressions operate on individuals based on who they are, but also the intersectionality of issues and systems, the systems that are keeping us down, all of us, in different ways. I mean, how do you communicate that to people without coming off as, well, you haven't read all the books, so I can't talk to you?
Right. That's a great, that's an awesome question. That's like such a, see that, that just like reveals like the depth of like experience and commitment to leadership you have, like that kind of a question. Like, because yeah, I mean, totally. It's like that, it's like, there's so much of this is about this like balance. It's not like, it's not this either or of like, either you're just like, oh my God, my politics are so much better than yours and I've read so much more and like what the hell is wrong with you? But it's also not going over into this like, okay, now we just like have like super general, like we just want good things in the world and whatever you believe is fine, you know? So I think again, it's this like, it's this balance. And so I think about it in terms of like, okay, we need to have millions and millions of people involved in, you know, and again, we break it off into the pieces that are going to work for us. So, you know, I'm trying to organize these 20 people over here, or, you know, these like, you know, 200 people there, or whatever it is. But we need to have a lot of people who are involved, who in this past presidential election really, really pushed me, and I know a lot of us, to think more deeply about what are important political commitments that we should not take for granted. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, for example, I'd be like, well, yeah, of course people are against Nazis and, you know, the Klan and, you know, but we need people to really understand institutional racism and, you know, the realities of like anti-black racism in this country and why Black Lives Matter movement is crucial, so on and so forth. But after the election, it was sort of like, well, you know what, actually, we need a lot of people who are against the Klan and neo-Nazis. That's actually really important and not something to just take for granted, that people are already going to be on board with that. There's actually some work that needs to be done to make sure that's true. And then we also then from there are also also doing this work around anti-black racism, around immigrant rights, around why Black Lives Matter is part of the leading edge of human rights for all of us, and a society that is healthy and has dignity for all of us, and so on. But we want to have people who are committed to a broad sense of economic justice, racial justice, gender justice. And so for me, like, I talk a lot about, you know, like economic inequality, the violence of economic inequality in this country. And generally, people who are open to wanting other people to have a good life, people have equal opportunity, people, you know, kind of a liberal democratic, which again is not something to take for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I love me some liberal Democrats, you know, I mean, I live in Kentucky. You know, when I lived in Tennessee, I would see the Democratic Party, out tabling at things. And I'd be like, I love you, Democratic Party. And, you know, and I know that's different in places where the Democratic Party is the majority. It's still the ruling party in different places. So I'm not saying that we just like look to the Democratic Party and we just say, good, as long as it's Democrats, it's all good. And we need to be nuanced enough to know that a Democrat in the presidential, in the White House is going to have significant impacts on how we live our lives in terms of what rights are going to be protected. What struggles are we going to have? You know, if the Supreme Court right now had not been packed by Trump, we would not be in this struggle of, oh my God, what is going to happen if these anti-abortion bans go to the Supreme Court? It's just one of many examples. And so, again, being able to build a broad progressive base is important. But also, we want to be nurturing and developing more and more. You know, for me, I want, you know, anti-racist, feminist, socialists, you know, who are thinking about how we expand democracy and build political power that really amplifies the dignity and humanity of all. I want people who are revolutionary, who are thinking about not just legislative change, but deeper structural changes to the economy. And I want a whole bunch of good people that are just like, abortion bans are wrong. Neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, wrong. What Trump is doing right now with immigrants and immigrant families, wrong. People, black people being killed in the streets of America, wrong. And if they were to say like, yes, I'm an anti-racist feminist socialist, awesome. But if they're just like, I'm an American and I don't want to see these things happen anymore, this is not the country I want to live in, I want that too. You know, like, so just a lot of different ways. But again, there's building a broad-based movement of millions of people, and then there's having your crew, your cadre, your organization, your people who you're able to really get political support from, political family, political home base of who you're able to strategize with and grow with and think with. So the movement is not your family.
Mm-hmm.
The movement is not your home. Your home is not going to be millions of people. You're going to be trying to kick people out, protect your space.
Mm-hmm.
You have to agree about all these 50 things before you're allowed entry. We are not trying to create political home in the movement. The movement is going to be a lot of different people, a lot of different values, a lot of different things that are going to be complicated, challenging, and we want millions of people to march against the abortion bans. We want millions of people to march against immigrant family separation. We want millions of people, millions and millions of people to demand voting rights and an end to voter suppression in the upcoming presidential election. We also want political homes of 5, 10, 30, mm-hmm. whatever it is, people where we really are helping each other grow in our political sophistication. We're able to have conversations that don't start at the basics where we have to explain everything.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to have a radio show like Praxis that's just awesome, and where people who are listening to it are probably not folks who are like, okay, so wait, like what's going on around? I mean, maybe they are. That's mm-hmm. awesome. Wherever you're at politically and you're listening to this, I love you. I'm mm-hmm. so happy you're listening. And having shows that are for people to really be growing in their political mm-hmm. thought, their political analysis. How can I be a more effective activist and organizer? Ugh.
Yeah.
It's precious. It's precious. So we need different kinds of resources, different kinds mm-hmm. of spaces, different kinds of leadership for different places that we're at in what kinds of a political home base of a small number of people that are growing and thriving for the long haul as political activists and revolutionaries, large scale, massive organizations, unions, political parties, coalitions, civic groups, where we're able to have tens of thousands more participate in positive change. Mm-hmm. We need those too.
Yeah.
So it's just like both and, you know, of like, I love you. You know, you're against economic inequality. You're not sure about this talk about capitalism, but also give it time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Couple years from now, boom, we might be having some kind of a
exactly.
Or if it's somebody who's like a Vietnam era activist who's got pretty solidly set politics, it might also be actually, you know what, the younger generation that's a lot more open to socialism, a lot more open to a deep critique of the capitalist system. Maybe it's actually about just helping to support more and more young people
mm-hmm.
coming into this activist world in a way where, you know, I mean, democratic socialism is something that young people are talking about in ways that I couldn't even imagine 5 years ago, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so things being yeah. ready for when things change, too.
Yeah, I really appreciate all this both and that helps me a lot because, and also, you know, I think I approached that person poorly, and it all goes back to like, what's more white supremacist than like an obsession with purity, you know? And I think
right,
that's been a
right.
problem with the left.
Absolutely. That's a yeah. huge one. That's a huge one.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, we're like completely out of time. I want you to have an opportunity to share if people have liked what they heard. I have your book sitting in front of me, which is called Towards Collective Liberation, Anti-Racist Organizing, Feminist Praxis, Wink, and Movement Building Strategy by Chris Crass. What other resources would you point people to? Where can folks find you online? All that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a website, chriscrass.org, and the other book is Towards the Other America, which is resources for white people taking action for Black Lives Matter. And it's really a lot around anti-Black racism, but also how do we, a lot of it's around organizing strategy. So interviews with a dozen different white anti-racist leaders, organizers working in different parts of the country, in the South, in labor unions in California, in working class rural communities in Maine, in Arkansas. You know, so a lot of anti-racist organizers working in different parts of the country with different kinds of people, and how they are helping to bring more and more white people into anti-racist work. And so a lot of different strategies that they use, a lot of different, you know, what have they learned? So in terms of thinking about how do we do anti-racist organizing, that's also, those interviews with people are a good resource. So it's towards the Other America and then towards collective liberation. And my website's chriscrass.org. And then there's a lot of books that are referenced in both of my books of things that have been really important to my own growth and development. But I just really encourage folks to, if you want to learn more about anti-racist organizing, to also learn about people, you know, like Anne Braden. And there's a biography about her called Subversive Southerner, which is just an incredible book. Mab Segrist has an incredible book called Memoirs of a Race Traitor. And, you know, Howard Zinn is just such a beautiful, I mean, he's been a role model for me around a white man, I mean, working class and Jewish. But for me as a white man, around really being deeply, deeply committed to multiracial movements, to people of color history, to feminism, to women's leadership, all from this profound, emotionally and spiritually grounded, just love and belief in everyday people and what kind of a world we want and what kind of a world we create and what kind of a world we create, not just in the future through legislation and electoral change, but also when we begin to struggle together and build a culture of solidarity and begin to join our hands and our hearts together, we start to create relationships and a way of being that starts to change the reality we live in now. So those are, you know, Howard Zinn, Mab Segrist, Anne Braden, learning about people like that and their examples is really important too. And definitely keep listening to this radio show, Praxis.
Well, shoot, thanks for the plug. And again, if you're just joining us at the end of the show and you missed any part, you can find the podcast. The easiest way to do that is to go to kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. And there's links there for pretty much any way you might want to listen to a podcast. If you have questions for me or suggestions, you can email me at praxis, again, P-R-A-X-I-S at kyrs.org. I will put all those book suggestions and a link to your site, Chris, on the podcast notes so folks can look for it there. And thanks so much for spending time with me today. It was great. I think we could talk a lot longer.
Oh, but absolutely.
It's an hour-long show.
This is beautiful.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for listening, and I'll be back next week with a new show.